This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. And don't forget, if we get to 2,000 paid subscribers by August of next year, Eve Beatty and I will cover the Theranos trial in person. That's bestevidence.fyi to get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox every weekday. And now, on with the episode.
Take your trust and they suck you in, and then they take your most prized possession and try to dement it.
If you're a McMartin parent now, you have to accept not being able to know certain things.
Oxygen's Uncovered series takes on the sine qua non of satanic panic cases, the McMartin preschool case, whose trial was the most expensive criminal proceeding to date and did little to illuminate what really happened at a Manhattan Beach pre-K in the early 80s. Quite a bit more illuminating and depressing is the second season of Bundyville from Long Reads and Oregon Public Radio, The Remnant, which finds host Leah Satilli and her team unpacking a seemingly random bombing in Nevada whose shockwaves reached further than anyone imagined. Never follow the puppet lady to a second location. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 105. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast about how true crime is told and sold. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined once again by Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
How's it going?
It's going okay. Before one of us is either struck by lightning or melts in a heat wave, let's get right to it,
All right. Shall we?
With our most wanted. Once again, we're working a little bit ahead. Uncovered, the McMartin Family Trials is going to air the 27th on Oxygen. The case file from Oxygen's landing page, in case you need a refresher, which I actually did, because I feel like I have heard the McMartin case referred to and that it's become this shorthand in the genre for a rush to judgment and blaming things on a satanic ritual. But I didn't actually know that much about the case. I didn't realize it was in California. Anyway, here is the case file from Oxygen's landing page. Uncovered, the McMartin Family Trials turns the lens to 1983, when a small South Bay community of Manhattan Beach was rocked to its core after a child from the prestigious McMartin preschool accused a teacher of molestation. What started out as one allegation soon became a media frenzy, with no shortage of children coming forward claiming to corroborate the story and add to the accusations. This led to 7 teachers being charged and 2 of them standing trial for heinous crimes, kicking off a 7-year trial that cost taxpayers $15 million and yielded 0 convictions. The claims were unsupported. Many people believed the children's testimonies were coerced, and the lives of the families involved were shattered. Leaving aside the crimes against proofreading in the previous paragraph, this for an Oxygen product I thought was surprisingly good. There were some melodramatic chyrons. We'll talk about it later. But for someone who was not all that familiar with this case, I thought this was very informative and not too fillery for an Oxygen product. Toby, what did you think of this generally?
I thought it was okay. It's got a lot of the stuff about that, a lot of that kind of cable genre has it, that drives me insane, like the dramatic music. And I think, well, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but I think they kind of ignore some of the bigger issues, especially looking back at it now and sort of people's, their memories of what happened or their takes, and how they just can't possibly be remembering the things they say they remember. It seemed a little weird that you'd have these people who are sort of put forth as first person witnesses. There's a woman who says that when she was like 3 years old, that she was sexually abused. There's no way that she remembers that accurately.
I mean, on the one hand, I think that this this episode, which is 2 hours long, like this is one of those series that's actually a series of movies, basically. I think it did a pretty good job showing restraint in terms of what it wants us to think it thinks about what happened.
Right.
But on the other hand, I do feel that in a case like this, you need to take more of a position on the patent bullshit that was flying around. Let me actually play clip two, and then we can talk about how it, you know, it's fine to sort of try to stay not objective, but to be circumspect as a program about what you think. But on the other hand, there's some information that we're not given, and I had to Google it. Here's clip two, and then we'll discuss.
The Manhattan Beach Police Department's a small department, and they had a female officer named Jane Hogue, who was kind of a tough old school cop, and so she interviewed that child. And the child, who was 2.5 years old, had said that Raymond Buckey had molested him.
Okay. This is where you begin to have a problem, is that the child is 2 years old. I mean,
right.
I'm not sure I could even make myself understood about likes and dislikes of food at 2 years old. Never mind something as dark as that. That's A. B, the woman who initially reported that, whose name is Judy Johnson, had many mental illness challenges. And I think before preliminary hearings were even underway, like literally drank herself to death.
Right.
So there are some reliability issues with her that are really not raised until like the last third of this show. And I think that that's a big problem. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a tough one because I think it's pretty clear that the allegations in this are wrong. I mean, I don't think anything really happened. So what you're making is you're trying to create some suspense to keep people watching rather than just saying, look at all this bullshit that happened. And so in doing that, you have to make the charges seem at least somewhat credible. And so there is through a whole lot of it. And I feel genuinely bad for these people. Like, the idea that, this comes up again, like my daughter's, you know, she's still in therapy and she's 37. It's mm-hmm. like, well, you know, the reason why she's in therapy is because in the course of having these discussions with these like quote unquote therapists, you know, she was influenced into believing that she got molested. And it's not that hard to do to influence people's memories, especially for a child. So, you know, it doesn't.
Well, and then, you know, all of the kids are sort of going through the process continuously. Like, this trial was like over half a decade.
Right.
This case dragged on.
Oh, you see the kids at the end, and they're, you know, they're in middle school, it looks like.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is like, well, one of the other things, the show is using a lot of talking head interviews with people who, claim that this happened, who, you know, were among the kids at the time, and with their parents, and these people, like, I don't think they're lying. It's like you said, like, eventually you sort of go over this situation enough times based on what adults want from you that you start to think it's true, or something else happened to this one survivor, and it wasn't at preschool, it was something else. If that makes any sense, like, I'm not sure this happened to her, but it's possible something analogous happened to her. Like, I'm always wanting to believe a survivor, but
right. Well, I think the thing,
but they're so young that it's just like how, like, children are very committed fabulists in every aspect of their lives. So I'm just right. not sure. You know, I'm not sure what the show wants us to feel, especially since this case, I sort of assumed that everybody knew that it was horseshit, but the show positions it as an open question.
Sort of.
And I'm not sure that works.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like it shaded towards it being unfounded, but they do, you know, they do give, and that's fine. Like, I think it's hard to have this and not give, you know, the quote unquote victims some kind of time. And I think it's genuinely tragic that these families like live with this hanging yeah. over them. But, you know, when I was working on this other podcast, you know, I talked to a woman who's out at, I think, Cal Irvine, who's like one of the leading experts in memory. And she's saying it's just really easy to influence people's memories, like adults' memories. And she says, you know, you interview people and you plan a suggestion to them. And then when you talk to them again 2 months later, that suggestion that you planted has become part of their memory. Like, they'll, when they recall something, they'll also recall that thing that you suggested.
Right.
So given that you can do that with adults, the idea, and especially the way they kind of describe these videos that are being taken, where they're like, you know, well, Jimmy said that this happened, and aren't you as smart as Jimmy? Like,
yeah.
Somebody else says it happens. I mean, it's really like at that point with the kids who are that young, like the idea that that would then have a lasting effect on them. Like, I mean, it just is so like a terrible practice, but be so believable that would have a lasting impact that it doesn't even seem to me to be really up for much discussion. You know, it seems like really the thing that happened here is you had sort of overzealous, undertrained people talking to these little kids.
Yeah.
And trying to get something out of them.
Who also maybe didn't know what we, you know, consider conventional wisdom now about how false confessions are elicited, about how memory is extremely fungible, like you were just saying. Like, that I think everybody involved meant well, but the amount of just junky science that's happening, and certainly the show has its opinions about, what's her face, Kee McFarland, the puppet lady, because yeah. there's this amazing, like, dramatical chyron when the show is talking about the parents were not content with the way Manhattan Beach police were handling this. So they went to the Children's Institute and got the puppet lady, and then this chyron comes up and it's like, enter the puppet lady. And it's like, God. I don't, like, that's hilarious, but I'm not sure we should be joking around about this. Like, lives were ruined, and no matter what actually happened to those children at the time,
right?
Now they've been traumatized. And on top of that, now they're not believed. So, yeah. So here's the introduction of the puppet lady in clip 3.
The parents weren't happy with the way the Manhattan Beach police talked to their children. And the DA suggested a more appropriate interviewer might be Kee McFarland at Children's Institute International.
I don't mind hearing them.
Kee McFarland had a charisma and asked questions with the puppets. It got the children to talk.
I remember being interviewed at CII, and I remember talking about experiences that had happened. It's not like I just remembered the bad stuff. There were good things I remember. you know, I remember playing. And then I remember some of the classrooms. And then I have flashes of some of the not so nice memories when it was just me and Ray Buckey.
I mean, that sort of trashy music cue aside.
I was about to say, and the laughing children for the happy moments.
Yeah, like, we get it. And then, I mean, I think it's telling in that clip, first of all, that it's like, it got the children to talk. Like, It didn't just get them to talk. It got them to say things that you apparently needed said for whatever reason. And the other thing that's striking to me about that is that kids are intuitive and like they know, they can sense things even if they don't have names for them. So it's possible that she just got kind of a Wiggins from Ray Buckey when she was little. Then where people are being charged with like hundreds of counts of molestation and corruption of a minor, and it just gets out of control. And that's sort of related to, I have another clip sort of along the same line. So here's clip four.
We had Elizabeth examined by Astrid. She said there was enough physical evidence to claim that there was something happened.
I mostly clip that because I think the way that's worded is interesting. Like, there's enough here that we can claim something happened. Like, is that how we're phrasing it? So that's a little off to me. But did you understand the Astrid they're talking about is Dr. Astrid Hager, who was a medical doctor, I believe, a pediatrician, and who is interviewed and was quite proud of herself for photographing these children and then being like, well, here we have evidence in photographs that they were molested. So I'm afraid I'm not clear. First of all, I'm not clear on what the evidence actually was. She was talking about blunt force trauma. Which I'm right. Like, are you talking about a very vigorous spanking? Because much of what is referred to, and it's possible they just don't like want to go there. But if you're going to make a program about this case, I'm afraid you're going to have to go there. But also, what? Like, I just feel like her whole approach was also extremely invasive while being also really vague at the same time. Was I missing something?
I don't think so. And isn't that the defense, I think, brought up other experts and had them look at the pictures, or did they cross-examine the other prosecutors? But we're basically like, can you show us where the evidence is? And they it didn't match up with what Astrid.
Yeah, it was something like that. And there was also, you know, with the videotapes, like there's a clip about that later where they're like, don't videotape these interviews when it takes you like three attempts over a week to get the kid to say what you want him to say. Like, so don't videotape it.
So I get that you want to document like the injuries just because, you know, they'll be gone, they'll heal. So I think the idea is, at the time at least,
right,
is that if you want to preserve the evidence, you've got to do it that way. I don't believe we do that now. I think there are, you know, specialized, you know, child trauma physicians who take a look and can make determinations without, you know, taking photos and all that stuff. So part of it, I mean, it's always amazing, like, you know, this is like 30 years ago, how freaking primitive it all seems, honestly.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell? And, you know, I mean, this is all happening when I was in high school and college. It didn't seem, I don't know, it's kind of alarming. But there was, you know, this is during the satanic panic, you know, and there was sort of in the air this sort of willingness to believe among some people, and especially in the psychiatric profession, there was a little movement that this stuff is real. Like, this is happening. Like, kids are being ritually abused, you know, people are being murdered. Like, there's this whole sort of satanic thing going on. And so in some ways it's like looking at it outside of that context, like, it seems even weirder that people would buy into it when.
But it was even a rumor, like, outside of like the courtroom framework or the law enforcement framework. Like, this was something that was said, for instance, in my hometown about certain like public lands and parks.
Oh, yeah.
After like, you know, after nightfall, that's when the Satanists go to the Watchung Reservation. Like, I don't think they do. But that was a thing said to scare kids and among kids to scare each other. And I don't think that's what they would say now.
No.
Like, I don't think that's what the kid rumor mill would be.
But I think they also, I mean, there's law enforcement took it seriously. I mean, there was, you know, there were people who went around and talked to police departments about, you know, the satanic conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. And, remember the, you know, self-styled expert in the West Memphis 3 case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that he's like, well, I got a couple books out of the library. Like, oh, cool. Neat. Me too. What?
Right, exactly. I got the Dungeons and Dragons Monster Manual, and this is what I learned.
This has come up in a couple of the recent episodes, and it's really making me think of it now, the concept that serial killers, for instance, or like disorganized presentation murderers have always existed. But because of the way society was constructed for, you know, millennia among humans leading up to, let's say, the Industrial Revolution or like the urbanization of many cultures, that the concept that humans could do these things to each other was so beyond the pale in terms of like maintaining the community in, I don't know, 1604, that the culture came up with things like vampires and werewolves and right. The Will of the Wisp, that it's like, well, you know, this can't be other people. And part of me feels like this satanic panic, like crowd contagion that was afflicting, I don't know what was happening outside of the States, but was afflicting the United States for like a decade and a half. And there's still people rotting in jail behind this shit.
Right.
It is similar, that it's like, I can't imagine that a human being not under the influence of, if not Satan himself, then some kind of satanic organization would molest children in this way. So this must be the reason. And it's
right.
Like,
and then it even goes from there to if an allegation is made, then it's sort of not wholly examined.
Yeah.
And there's a willingness to believe that, oh shit, this fits into that framework. Did you, there was a, it must have been in the 90s, a New Yorker article called Remembering Satan. Did you see that?
I'm sure I've read that.
I think it's up in Washington or Oregon, but it's about a guy whose daughters basically accuse him of, you know, being part of a satanic circle that sexually abused them.
There's like seven different women who self-published memoirs saying that their Satanist fathers killed the Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Yeah. And this guy totally, like, he was like, oh shit, like, there's no way they would lie about that. I must, like, not remember it happening. I must have been, you know, possessed when I did it. And it's just, he totally buys it. And it's because these girls like went to see this fundamentalist preacher who's cruising around, and then they sort of came up with this story for whatever reason. So it's nuts.
Yeah, part of it is like, I have a little part of me has compassion for these people who choose to assign what they see as this horrendous thing that has befallen them and their children to satanic ritual, because it's, if it's the only way they can get their minds around it, it sort of gives them a way to organize it, like, emotionally. But law enforcement needs to be better than that, and they weren't at, right, like, ever. Like, when is a time, I guess we just don't hear about it, but it would be nice if one of these documentaries was just like 17 minutes long and someone goes to the cops and is like, it was Satan, and the cops are like, no.
Yeah.
But it's a pentagram, like, that's just an A.
Right.
It wasn't Satan. Please go lie down. We'll talk tomorrow.
Well, so they find that plate with like the pentagram on it. I'm like, it looks startlingly like a star.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. The whole.
I know.
Sorry. I'm sure there's another clip.
I don't. I feel bad like making fun of people who really believe that this happened and have been suffering with what they remember, even if it's incorrect, for decades. But I mean,
yeah, I don't.
Y'all. No.
Yeah. It's hard to blame them again, because I think if you think your kid has been sexually abused, like the trauma and anger that must provoke. So, you know, I'm not going to like blame or demean somebody for whatever their reaction is going to be.
I don't judge them for.
But the institutional people should be trying to be like,
responsible.
Yeah, just be rational. Like,
yeah.
Like, just talk to them in rationally about what's going on. And, you know, somebody's got to say, look, you know, you're not finding tunnels, you're digging tunnels.
Yeah.
Like, there's a difference.
In order to be like, see, there's a tunnel here. Like, well, now there is.
Yeah, exactly. That's weird. That's so weird that there's a tunnel after you've been digging all this time.
Any of this works. And is it possible that because someone mentioned it to you, now you think you remember it? Yeah. I just, the whole thing is so sad. And, you know, I actually am sort of serious when I say this. Like, Anton LaVey didn't make himself hard to find. If you'd like to know whether this might be a Satanist situation, I don't know. Call him up and ask.
Dial a Satanist.
Yeah. Like, is this something that you do? He'd be like, no. Like, we're not fucking with that.
I mean,
I shouldn't laugh. The other, talking about institutions being responsible, thank you for that segue. The media was not. Here is a clip from, we're starting out hearing from local reporter Wayne Satz, who, as it turns out, was doing it with Key McFarland. Did he disclose that? No, he didn't. Was it in his interest to report this in a perhaps more sober-sided fashion? It was not. Here's clip five.
It started out here in Manhattan Beach looking like an isolated incident. One mother noticed that her young son was having nightmares and difficulty sitting down and a redness on his bottom. Authorities would later conclude that her two-year-old son had been sodomized. That was last summer. In the months since then, the number of possible victims have multiplied, to say the least.
Wayne Satz was a highly respected Peabody Award-winning reporter. I'm sure he kind of thought the way any reporter would have thought. This is like a great story. And he happened to have access to Key McFarland because he was dating Key McFarland.
That reporter had the inside information from the beginning on what these children were saying to the interviewers. And it was blasted daily on Channel 7 in the most horrendous fashion.
I mean, I don't know, a two-year-old having nightmares with redness on his bottom? What is your Occam's razor interpretation right. of that? Because no. I don't have kids, but I had a much younger brother and a niece and nephew, and that sounds like normal night terrors and diaper rash to me.
That would be my interpretation as well. Or Satanists.
Yeah, or Satanists. You know. Certainly, diaper rash would seem to be the work of the Dark Lord. There's no place for that in a godly ecosystem. We have one more clip that I pulled because Elizabeth, I'm not actually sure how you pronounce that last name, Chioffi, let's say. We've heard from her in previous clips. She is one of the alleged, I guess we have to say, survivors who talks about, she was talking about remembering being alone with Ray Buckey. And here we're going to hear two conflicting sides of whether pressing a basically toddler to get a story out of them is appropriate or effective. If you're going to actually elicit something that happened, here's clip six.
I never saw any spontaneous comment from a child that something untoward happened. In fact, some of them couldn't even identify the major suspect, Ray Buckey.
If you want to convict somebody, don't videotape it. Keep secret how many times it took you to get them to say the right words that you can write down and report.
You're talking to a three-year-old. You have to lead them. They're not going to just say, oh, I was molested, and we had to do this, and we had to do that. My daughter doesn't just tell me what happened at school when I ask her what happened at school today. I have to kind of prod her and encourage her. It's not easy to interview a three-year-old and expect them to be able to just spit out what happened. So you have to lead them when you ask them questions.
That's a fair point, but, you know,
maybe
once you've been leading them for, I'm going to say, 10 or 15 minutes, and it doesn't seem apparent that they're even wanting to go into the neighborhood that you want to lead them to, maybe the reason isn't that they're three and they need to be interviewed by an expert mom. It's that maybe nothing happened.
You know, and this is one of my issues with this documentary, and a lot of documentaries for that matter, is why don't you just go and find an expert in interviewing little kids and ask them how it goes? You know, instead of like talking to this old sort of crusty lawyer and then this woman who, you know, and again, I'm not demeaning her. I'm sure it's her genuine memory, but she's coming at it from a framework of I was sexually molested and that was how they had to get that information out of me. You know, why not just talk? I mean, there's, you know, I'm sure like every three counties in the United States has got at least one person who specializes in talking to very, very young kids about traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
So just ask them how it goes. I mean, it's easy. Like, I don't know why you wouldn't do that.
Yeah. I don't either. I think actually the guy we heard from at the top of the clip was he might have been a like forensic psychologist of some kind. He was wearing an eye patch, which I found.
I don't feel like I got much of a handle on. He seemed like he was maybe an academic. I don't know. Mm. Anyway, he had quite a bit.
But no, you're totally right. Call up Mariska Hargitay. She's done it enough times in, you know, scripted form. She probably knows more than the average civilian.
Whenever I watch these things, I'm like, what would Frontline have done with that? Like, I think there's some like genuinely super interesting questions around this case that I don't think we really get to because the framing is, did they or didn't they? And it's pretty freaking clear that they didn't. So, you know, what what is there to look at? Because I think it's genuinely very interesting, and I don't think they examine any of those questions.
Yeah, or they're trying to be. I appreciate that in a piece of Oxygen product that they are, as I said, more restrained than usual. Maybe it's because I'm coming off a episode where we were talking about Nancy Grace, who, never any gray area with that one. And whether it's out of respect for alleged survivors who genuinely believe that something happened and have suffered, maybe it's more cynical, like to ensure their cooperation, whatever the case, I appreciate that it's not as sweaty as the average Oxygen thing would be. But I mean, now that you mention it, I feel like Frontline has done something on this case, and in the absence of any other materials on it, if you do want an overview of why this has become a shorthand for the satanic panic, not craze, it's not a hula hoop, you know what I mean, period. It's a
phenomenon.
Yes. Dark night of the law enforcement.
Mass
soul.
Delusion.
Yes, there you go. But I mean, this is pretty good for Oxygen, but now that you've been like, well, I just wish that we could find out what Frontline would do with this, I'm like, well, yeah. We really need is Frontline, or like something from POV, some public trust, public television take on it that's not going to have a chyron that says enter the puppet lady, because, I mean, that's a problem. And I shouldn't be laughing.
But ask the bigger question about, you know, what does this mean? What does it mean that, you know, we're willing to take, you know, six or seven people who, like, I think even, like, except for, like, the hardest core, everybody's guilty. But, I mean, I think most people took a look at those five who were exonerated right away and sort of comprehend that they're innocent. But why were people willing to believe that they'd molested 300 and something kids?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's insane. I mean, that's just crazy. If it actually happened.
Just like logistically, it's bonkers.
Yeah. And like these kids weren't like freaking out and not wanting to go back to school and stuff. I mean, I don't know. It's just the whole thing seems like there's a lot of questions about how do you get people to wholeheartedly believe that stuff, and that's sort of more interesting than did they or didn't they?
Because, well, yeah, and that's not
they didn't.
I don't think Oxygen is as a network set up for that second order analysis. I think it's a did they or didn't they shop. They're running over there, and that's fine. But I would rather know, like, not only how did this happen, but how did it finally stop happening all across the country? Like, what was it that had us like gripped by this for this period, and then what released the grip of this delusion, like you said?
Yeah.
Anyway, that is Uncovered, the McMartin Family Trials. It will be airing this, I guess that's Saturday, on Oxygen, probably at their like weird premiere time of 6 p.m. I don't know why they do that, but check your local listings. All right, moving on to a much more satisfying analysis, I suspect. We're talking about a podcast in the cold case section, Bundyville, The Remnant. I can give the case file, but Toby, you suggested that we talk about this one. Do you want to talk about why you brought it to us?
Sure. Because I thought it was great when I listened to it. But so this is the second season of Bundyville, which the main reporter is Leah Satilli. And the first season was really about sort of the story of Cliven Bundy and his sons. And Cliven Bundy was the guy who had the big standoff with the federal government over his right to graze his cattle for free on public lands. And then later, one of his sons led the occupation of the Malheur National Forest or whatever it was site that ended up with a couple of people being killed. So they're sort of patriot movement types. So the second season, which I thought was fascinating, is about sort of, you know, right-wing extremism of a certain type, which is, you know, it's kind of patriot movement and also like really strange Christianity. And it starts off with a guy who basically blows himself up outside a former friend's house in like the middle of nowhere in Arizona. And, you know, the audio they have of what happened, which I think is from a 911 call,
yeah,
is amazing. But then from there, like each one of the episodes is sort of, it's almost its own sort of self-contained thing, but it's a little bit like, you know, Heart of Darkness or Apocalypse Now, where you're going deeper and deeper into this sort of realm of this kind of patriot conspiracy thought. And I just thought every episode was really compelling and interesting. And that's why I suggested it.
Yeah, the case file is pretty much that. The Remnant goes on to explore the world beyond the Bundy family and the armed uprisings they inspired. The series investigates extremist violence that results from the conspiracy theories of anti-government movements. Who is inspiring that violence and who stands to benefit? This is extremely well made. I actually hadn't gotten around to listening to the first season yet, but this is, there are moments where it's like a little public radio-y, like verging into someone knows something territory, but she's getting so much information into every episode, and they're really not very long episodes. I think the longest one is like 38 minutes.
Yeah.
But there's no, I mean, when I was listening, I was interrupted by ads for, you know, Milk Hemp and Casper mattresses.
Right.
Like, bless their hearts, but it really felt very dense, but without being homeworky. Here is a clip of her sort of locating you, this bomb, the initial bomb, which sets off her investigation, or is like the ground zero, I guess, unfortunately, is the right term for her investigation. It's in Panaca, Nevada, and this guy she's talking to is the county sheriff and also the coroner and the fire chief and the dog catcher and...
It's not a big town.
No. Chief cook and bottle washer. This is very flavorful tape, as our colleague Rebecca Lavoy would say. Here is clip 7.
Okay, so he's at the scene, and he's got body parts. That means coroner hat. Sheriff Lee told me and my producer, Ryan Haas, that it's his job to identify whose limbs were scattered everywhere. But he can't really ID anyone with just some legs.
And we did not actually find the upper torso, which is what we needed for identification. I don't care about the leg. I mean, I do care, but that's not my... I need the torso. I need legs. I need fingerprints. I need dental records. I need that type of stuff to be able to identify somebody.
It took investigators about 14 hours to find the top half of Glenn Jones. And when they did, he wasn't laid out on his back and easy to identify.
He was in a tree in the neighbor's yard. Yeah.
I mean, just think about everything that evokes, not just a torso in a tree, but that it had been there for 14 hours. And you have to wonder, like, how many people sort of just walked under it.
And then you've got this, like, totally...
Before someone happened to, like, stretch their necks and they were like, guys? It's really good. It really locates you. She's very... her descriptions are very evocative.
And the guy's attitude is great too. The way he's like talking about it and stuff. It also kind of evokes a certain
yeah.
you know.
But he's like, not that I don't care about the legs, but you know what I mean. I just found that very funny that it's like, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So that was from the first episode. The second episode I thought was just incredible, where she has this extended interview with a guy who the government believes is the most dangerous militia person in the country. And she has this long conversation with him.
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
And then it's interspersed. I thought about pulling a clip of the part where she's like, let's just be clear. I couldn't verify most of Keebler's claims. And then she sort of is sarcastic about his kung fu system that he tried to patent or whatever. And she's like, but I'm not here to verify whether he won third place at a kung fu competition. I'm here to, and it's really well done. It's not like too snarky. It's just the right amount of snarky. And a clip I do have is where she's applying that same level of like very slightly acidic commentary to the fact that I'll just play the clip because it's evident what she's talking about.
First of all, you're killing men's cattle, dumbass. Two, you're killing whoever's in that truck.
But Brad Miller wasn't just a cattle-killing dumbass. He was actually an undercover FBI agent. In fact, at varying times, there were three confidential informants and three undercover FBI agents in Keebler's militia. So, if you take away Keebler, the FBI agents, and informants, there were, at most, just three members of PDF militia. All this time, Finicum and Keebler had been planning a confrontation with federal agents with the help of federal agents.
The way that she does this is incredibly skillful because there are many questions about, like, how do you infiltrate and stop organizations like this without leading them or entrapping them into doing something? And what is your responsibility as a government to patrol the line where hate speech turns into hate action? And what is your responsibility in terms of doing whatever you have to do, even if it crosses the line legally and ethically, to make sure that doesn't happen, or to like induce a felony that you can lock these people up with? And she also talks to federal, attorneys or law enforcement agents who were just talking about, like, post 9/11, the standards for entrapment were just like discarded, like put in a drawer to give greater latitude to agents. And she kind of raises all of these questions and then lets the listener do what she's going to do with them and doesn't really underline it too much. And I was very impressed by that in this and following episodes, that she was able to suffuse her descriptions with, through lines of the issues that we're talking about here, but without lecturing or making it feel like homework. So I thought that was great.
Yeah. And she does make the point with what you were just talking about, that, you know, the justification for it is, you know, if we can talk somebody into it, somebody else can talk that same person into
it.
So, you know, especially when they're talking about the rationale behind trying to entrap, I think particularly who they consider Muslim extremists, is if we can talk them into doing it, ISIS can talk them into doing it. What I think was the comparison he made.
Right.
So, you know, again, I think that's, you know, I have my questions about that justification, but it is, she lays it out there without putting her finger on the scale too much.
Well, yeah, and she gets the effective soundbite from the interviewee, which is sort of half the battle. And in addition, like, when you're talking about targets, I guess is the term they'd use, who like a big part of their grand ununified theory of government-free living has to do with amassing weaponry without any constraints, then I think it's a different conversation from like a bunch of whatever teenagers on the internet,
right,
talking about doing it versus a guy who, you know, for a fact has like 300 handguns doing it. It's a little different. Yeah, I haven't listened to the very last episode where I assume she sort of brings it all back around.
Yeah.
I'm excited to get into that. But I loved that this journey sort of takes us further and further away from the original, like the point of origin of the story in Nevada, but it's sort of always in sight. And as a listener, you trust her to bring it back around. Like, it's not always evident where it's going, but you know it's going somewhere.
Yeah, and she does. I mean, the last episode is very does a good job of bringing everything back.
There are a couple of spots in like episode 5 or 6, I think it's 6, where she's talking to someone who left the marble country.
Yep.
And like the similarity to leaving a cult, where that felt a little squishy. But I could sort of see editorially, like, well, you can't really, like, once you've brought up the cults, you can't cut this guy's tape. What did you think of that section?
I thought that was the weakest of them all, which I mean I still thought it was good and interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But the rest of it is so excellent that, you know, that just being like good, like, kind of stood out
in a somewhat negative way,
I guess. But I thought, you know, again, she doesn't really come out and talk about this. But it does kind of build this case of, you know, in these groups, there's almost like a religion of America, right? In that, like, the concept of America takes on these sort of mystical properties and is their justification for doing the kinds of, like, freaking awful things that you generally see being done in the name of religion.
Right.
And, you know, I found that to be pretty interesting, because you kind of combine that with some pretty unorthodox, like, Christian views.
Mm.
And you kind of meld them together, and it's really, you know, it's pretty toxic.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way it comes out. And, you know, one of the things, but there's a point at which she's talking to these guys who are like hardcore white separatists, patriot movement guys. And they're talking about that marble country, which is like I guess it's a town. It's a little hard to tell. It's like a geographic area.
Yeah, I felt like it was like the Pacific Northwest white separatist version of Clearwater, Florida.
Yeah.
Might be a good way to think about it, but anyway.
Yeah, it's like an enclave, but it's kind of the guy, the person who's kind of in charge is this wealthy guy who gives a lot of money to these super fringe candidates, including this one guy in Washington State. But she's talking to these like hardcore white supremacists, and they're like, oh yeah, there's no freaking way we would go there. Like, that place is scary as hell. If we went there, we'd be armed. And she's like, well, I guess I gotta go. And so she goes.
She's like, but I wasn't armed and I didn't wear a bulletproof vest. I was like, God damn it, Leah.
Yeah.
Like,
so, which is,
we're listening to this podcast. You obviously didn't get killed.
Right.
But
it's a hard ass move. And
yeah, I can't imagine
like doing something like that. So I'm coming off a little gushy, I think, but I really, this was one of the better podcasts I've listened to in a while.
Well, it's not easy material to just take the listener through because it's all such flashpoint stuff. And another place that she's where she's really good is, I mean, it's sort of twofold, like talking about, first of all, people who've been covering some of these like Aryan Nation type groups for decades, and we're sort of like finally putting together that a bunch of these crimes were related. We'll hear about that in a clip in a second, but the sort of conversation about whether to cover these groups, lest the coverage be like PR for them, versus shining a light on the hateful things they do and think. So that was really good. And she got great tape from this guy that she talked to. And she does a good job as well, like sort of not listing, but like there are a number of, not dog whistle terms, but like Christian covenant, I think is one of them, that it's like, that's code that I wouldn't have known. But there are a lot of like terms that sound just sort of like standard Jesus-y and probably not for me, but actually are anti-government, anti-people of color.
Right.
I mean, it's like the information, it's informative. The information is bleak, but there's a good... it's sort of like how domestic terrorists become radicalized. It, you know, it may not make sense to us, but this is how it's happening. Way that she has with these incidents that, you know, I don't really feel like going to Eastern Washington anytime soon. No offense, Eastern Washington. I'm just like afraid to take a wrong turn and end up with a rifle pointed into my car like this reporter.
Are you talking about Western Liberty?
I guess.
So one of the episodes is about this state rep in Washington who wants to cleave off Eastern Washington and attach it to part of Idaho and call and make it a state called Liberty.
In his timbre, his voice sounds a lot like David Miscavige. Just putting that out there.
This guy is nuts.
Yeah, he is a whole bowl of Fruit Loops.
And they keep finding out this stuff about him, including he like writes this little manifesto about like how if I think I'm getting this right, that if people don't convert to his like sort of vision of what Christianity ought to be, that you go and you kill all the males.
I mean, it's not.
And
very...
then he gets reelected easily after that comes out. So people are like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And she's like, either people don't know what he's really about, or they don't care, or they actually agree. And I don't know which one is more scary. And I'm like, why choose? They're all horrifying.
Exactly. It's just.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it's a lot. And this is the front line on this topic, basically, that we were looking for about the McMartin case. Like,
this is an undercovered story. You know? This is where the domestic terrorism largely comes from. From this. And for whatever reason, and I've got my theories, it's really just not aggressively reported.
Well, I think it's what I was talking about before, at times at least, that news organizations don't want to shine a light on this stuff because they're afraid that it's advertising it.
Yeah. And I also think there's a certain... I think the liberal media thing... I think is also intimidating.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's just like, oh, typical liberal media. And I think there's sort of bending over backwards to not like, again, I don't know why, if I was a conservative, I don't think I would defend these guys, but you know, Fox News, I mean, Sean Hannity was all in a lather when Cliven Bundy had that standoff. I mean,
oh yeah. Well, I mean,
he's all in his corner. I mean,
Ruby Ridge and Waco created a lot of outside the box thinking, let's say, about
that's a nice way of putting it.
The role of government. She sort of traces the bloodline, to use an unfortunate turn of phrase, of some of that anti-government paranoia through Ruby Ridge. Let's hear the last clip, because I think it's instructive as to, you know, how long it kind of took the non-Aryan locals in this part of the country to figure, and law enforcement, to figure out that all of these things were connected, and that it was part of a, it wasn't just a crime spree, it was like a way of life, in our last clip.
It didn't take long for the order to start killing people. Moreland says a litany of violence began in 1984 with the murder of a Jewish radio host in Denver.
Following that, there were robberies of an adult bookstore in Spokane, the bombing of a synagogue in Boise, the robbery of an armored car in the Seattle area, the printing of counterfeit money on the presses of the Aryan Nations, and then probably one of the hallmark crimes was the robbery of an armored car near Ukiah, California, that netted something on the order of, $4 to $5 million in cold cash in the money bags.
And it was all these crimes were meant to inspire and bankroll a white revolution. It's easy to look back now and see how they were connected. But at the time, the FBI had trouble figuring out who was committing all of them.
And this is in an era before the term terrorist meant anything to anybody. I mean, it's like domestic terrorism. What's that?
I think Ukiah is Jim Jones country also. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think that was like his stop point between when he was in Indiana and then he went to Ukiah.
Yeah,
and then
I think that's
he
right.
He went to San Francisco.
Yeah. And we know the rest. I'm excited to listen to the last episode. I'm not sure I would have made time for this if you hadn't brought it up, and I'm very glad that you did. It's excellent reporting. It's it's well-paced listen, well-built. It's not, not the most fun that you ever had in your life to listen to, but it's so well done and so interesting, and it is underreported, and I think I understand why, but I hope a lot of people listen to this. And it sounds, based on what I'm seeing on Twitter and in the true crime podcast sphere, that it's getting a lot of play, and it should. It's definitely worth your time. Best thing I've listened to in a while.
Definitely.
Toby, where else can listeners find you when you're not melting on my roof?
So I am weekly or every other week during the summer on Crime Writers On. I have a Patreon book club podcast called The Deep Dive that Sarah is on all the time.
I love it.
The one that's coming up soon is we talk about the new Jim Crow, which is a incredible book about how mass incarceration is sort of the new way of sort of controlling, African-American men is essentially in this, but minorities in general.
Yeah.
And Madeline Barron and Marsha Chatelain and a professor named Shirley Leroux discuss it. It's a super interesting discussion. Should be out any day now. That's basically where to find me. You can also find me on Twitter at Toby Ball. NH. That's all I got right now.
All right, cool. Thanks for coming downstairs and grabbing the last Diet Coke to do this.
It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thanks, man. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, No One Saw a Thing with Allison Lohuff, Free Meek Mill with Eve Beatty, Alex Segura is back to talk Leah Carroll and Yahweh Ben Yahweh, and John Ramos will rejoin me to despair of the entire Gimelstob family. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents across all social media. And at Eve's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. And again, 2,000 paid subscribers mean we cover the Theranos trial. You got 13 months, so get after it. My guest has been Toby Ball, and he's on Twitter at roof.org. Just kidding. As he said, it's Toby Ball NH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.